Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host, Dr. Reed Robison, and I are joined by Dr. Christopher Baish, PhD. Chris is a professor emeritus in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies at Youngstown State University, adjunct faculty at the California Institute for Integral Studies, emeritus fellow at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and on the advisory council of Groff Legacy Training. He's the author of several books, but the one that prompted us to reach out to him for this interview is LSD and the Mind of the Universe, an account of what Chris experienced and learned from 73 high-dose LSD journeys that he embarked on over the course of 20 years. In today's conversation, we explore Chris's LSD session protocol, the difference between using psychedelics for what he calls cosmological exploration versus spiritual enlightenment or even psychological healing. Talk about how Chris processed and integrated his very intense experiences, what he learned about reincarnation, evolution at the collective and individual levels, what humans need to do to survive the mounting existential threats we face, what he means by diamond luminosity and diamond soul, and of course, much, much more. Chris's book had a profound impact on me. His disciplined, scholarly approach to psychedelic exploration, combined with his ability to articulate and teach what for most of us would be an overwhelming or ineffable experience, has resulted in a must-read, in my opinion, for anyone who thinks deeply about questions like who are we, what are we doing here, and where we might go from here. If you've ever listened to an episode of Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers and thought to yourself, you know, I wonder where I could find good training on how to use psychedelics in a clinical practice, well, wonder no longer. Numinous has several excellent psychedelic therapy training programs. Click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/our-training-selection and use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. You hear Reed and I talk a lot about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. If you or someone you know is interested or might be interested in being a participant in a psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn about the trials we're currently running. If you'd like to support the show, you can do so by leaving us a rating and review in places like Apple Podcasts or Spotify. If you're watching on YouTube, please click the like button, subscribe to the channel, or share the episode with somebody you think might enjoy it. Please enjoy our conversation with Dr. Chris Baish. Welcome back, folks, to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers. Reed and I are very honored today to be joined by Dr. Chris Baish. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here with you today.
So why don't we just start, Chris, by introducing yourself to our audience, and you can, you know, share as much or as little as you'd like, so just to give us some context.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a retired professor of religious studies. I made my living teaching in the Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies in Youngstown State University, which is a state university in Northeast Ohio. So what brings me to this program, I guess, is the book that I published 3 years ago called LSD and the Mind of the Universe, which is a strange book for a professor of religious studies to have written. So my story is that right at the very beginning of my academic career, 1978, I just finished my graduate work at Brown in philosophy of religion, and I met the work of Stan Grof, and I immediately recognized that his research and LSD psychedelics in general were extraordinarily important, not just for clinical psychology and for therapy, but for philosophy, which was what interested me the most. And so I began, even though it was illegal, I began a quiet, private psychedelic practice, which ended up continuing for 20 years. I worked for 4 years. I then stopped for 6 years for reasons I describe in the book. And then I worked for another 10 years. And then I spent another 10 years this is from 79 to 99, when I was 30 to 50. And then I spent the next 20 years digesting those experiences, trying to absorb them, trying to extrapolate and clarify the cosmological implications of those experiences. And then I published LSD and the Mind of the Universe. So that's kind of a brief sketch of what brings me here.
Yeah, it's and I remember as I was reading your book, I was thinking, what a heroic undertaking. And I don't know if heroic is a word that lands for you, Chris, but I mean, heroic in the sense of a hero's journey. The things you describe in the book, the experiences that you had, not for the faint of heart. And I've heard you say that you don't necessarily recommend the protocol, the things that you did to others. And I was curious as to why.
Well, first, let me describe the protocol. First, everything I did was within a strict therapeutic protocol. I followed Stan's protocols from his book, LSD Psychotherapy. So traditional is lying down, eye shades, earphones, listening to very carefully choreographed music to guide the session. I was always in private, always protected, always with a sitter, who was my wife at the time, who was a clinical psychologist. So established in what I call the psychedelic kiva, and you know, a kiva of spiritual practice. For reasons that we can go into, but we don't need to, I chose to work with very high doses of LSD. After about three sessions at 250 micrograms, I chose to work at 500 to 600 micrograms, which is the upper limit. It's the body's saturation point. And naively, I was thinking at the time that this work was about personal transformation, even personal spiritual awakening. And all the spiritual literature described one's karma ultimately as finite, even though it may involve, you know, causation patterns from multiple incarnations, but ultimately it's finite. So I thought of this therapeutic work as a process of clearing the conditioning of my psyche and essentially engaging and clarifying and purifying karma. And I thought if I worked with large doses of LSD, I could basically go through this faster if I could manage the intensity of the work, essentially taking bigger bites of karma in every session. Well, I found out down the road that all those assumptions I was making were wrong. This work was not about personal transformation, not working at this high dose level. If you're working with a gentler psychedelic or in lower doses, then the activation and the purification and the healing that would take place might be constricted or to personal levels. But if you're working with a very powerful psychedelic like this much LSD, you basically amplify consciousness so deeply that what may have begun as a personal transformative process becomes engaged in collective processes that having to do with the collective unconscious, the species mind, and from there you're off to the races into deeper and deeper levels of consciousness, cycles of death and rebirth, not just ego death, and ego death is the first of many deaths that you face on this journey. But as you go through one level of consciousness after another systematically, you go through many forms of death that are more foreign, perhaps, than ego death. So that's why I don't recommend the protocol, because it's an extremely demanding protocol. It basically becomes the center focus of much of your life just to engage these deep states, to navigate them, to absorb them and integrate them into your life and integrate them into your social life and into your body. I thought that there was an end point to this journey. You know, one of my false assumptions was the reason for doing this work was to get somewhere, you know, to get to enlightenment or to become one with God or to enter into the primal void of existence. And I had all of those experiences, and I discovered that there were many levels of divinity that one can enter into communion with, and there were even many levels of the pure void, of the fertile void. And about 15 years into my experience, I had a particular experience when I was as deep into the universe as I would ever go deep into what I call the diamond luminosity domain. And I had an experience that I saw reality far, far into the distance, and a beam of light hit me from that reality, and it shattered me. It just shattered me, and I was in a very high and subtle state of consciousness, and that's when I realized it's an infinite journey. You'll never get to the end of the universe. The universe is just too vast. The depth of the divinity is just so great. So now that if I were to start this journey over again, I would be much gentler with myself. I'd work with I'd balance low dose, high dose, organic psychedelics, synthetic psychedelics. Because now I understand that the real goal of this work is to open yourself, to let in as much of the love and intelligence and wisdom of the universe as you can into your system, and then to digest it and hold on to it and draw it into your life and let it guide you. And it's not about getting to some final destination.
That's beautiful, Chris. Thank you for sharing. So many questions come up, but one thing I wanted to ask along those lines is, what do you think the risks are of going straight to those higher deep states, like going to the higher doses and perhaps bypassing some of the healing work or the lower dose work? Is there a little more you can share on how you might use those two different dose ranges as tools?
Yeah. Well, first of all, any work with psychedelics, especially if you're working with higher doses in a therapeutic protocol, any work with psychedelics can be challenging and therefore calls for good psychological screening to make sure that you have a psyche that's ready to engage these deep levels. As you know, there are some people who should never go near psychedelics. And there are some people who should really work very gently with psychedelics if they work with psychedelics at all. I happen to have a constitution that can become large or can flow into expansive states pretty readily and congeal pretty readily and smoothly at the end of the day. Not everybody is wired like that. Mm-hmm. And so it's, you know, all the cautions have to be taken, all the clinical, you know, criteria have to be met for this type of work. Now, if you work with high doses, you can bypass. I mean, you can get into situations where you can chase a particular level of experience and bypass, but that didn't happen to me. It wasn't part of my work. I spent the first 10 sessions and 2.5 years in very grueling kind of work within what Stan calls the perinatal level of consciousness, the interface between your personal unconscious and the collective or transpersonal consciousness. So it's, you know, you're reliving your birth, you're dealing with all sorts of existential crises, you're really grinding things very deeply at that level. Now, I will say that late in my sessions, rather late, I mean, 15 years down the road, I mean, there was lots of personal healing that took place along the way. Don't get me wrong. There were personal healings that took place in those first 10 sessions and other down the road. Often they would take place at the beginning and ending of my sessions. When I was leaving space-time and when I was coming back into space-time, because when I was working in the peak of the sessions, after about, you know, the first 2 or 3 years of work, I was working in states of consciousness that were far beyond my personal consciousness and far beyond space-time even. So, but along the way, you know, packaged around the areas, there was lots of healing of different parts. And late in the sessions, there was some very quick healings of pieces of my life. And I think if I had been working with lower doses, those healings would have taken place earlier. But I found that in my particular instance, I don't think it was because I was jumping over any problems or I was not willing to confront any problems, because the things you confront at the deep levels of the psyche are much, much more severe than anything that you confront at the personal level of the psyche. And I want to say that, you know, I came into this work, I wasn't carrying any personal trauma. I had a pretty easy start in life. I had good parents, good home environment, nothing more than the ordinary push-pull in a family. And so there wasn't a deep wound that I took into this work. Other than the deeper wound is really the wounds that everybody, every human being carries when they enter time and space. That is the wound of stabilizing within time and space and understanding why we are here. What is the whole purpose of my existence in this domain? And can I discover what my reason for being here is? And can I enter into communion with the intelligence that I believe saturates all existence? So in my particular case, what I found was that, and I have to say this carefully for someone who doesn't know my work, it may sound grandiose and I apologize for that, but I found that my personal wounds were not kind of healed until late in my work, because it was my personal wounds that anchored me in the larger fields of consciousness in such a way that it allowed me to accomplish or to be used to accomplish some of the healing of the collective psyche that took place in my work. And that is, it's like the way I describe it in the book, my personal wound anchored one side of a bridge and the other side of the bridge was the collective psyche. Mm-hmm. And by having that bridge, when I went deep into awareness, consciousness, it allowed my sessions to become a conduit to pull some of the pain of the collective psyche out of the collective psyche and to transform it. And if my personal wounds had been healed early on, that ability to do that would have been compromised. And what I learned along the way is that this function, this specific function to engage the collective psyche in a way to bring a certain measure of healing to it was part of my soul's work. It was something that I kind of signed up for in this incarnation. And I think personally, I think there are a lot of people who are doing this type of work and have signed up for this type of work. I don't think there's anything special or unusual about my choice to do this work.
It is, from our perspective, a very brave hero's journey, as Steve mentioned earlier when we were chatting. But I'm also curious about that disposition you mentioned, because it comes into play in people we work with and a lot of questions we get. How much of it do you think is nature versus nurture? How much can you cultivate as an ability to expand and hold those states without, you know, shattering into overwhelm or getting discombobulated? Wondering if you have some thoughts on that.
I'm sure you can. I mean, I know we can learn how to enter these states more skillfully. Some people have a natural aptitude for moving into them, but whatever the level of aptitude is, we practice in these states and we enter into them carefully. And if you enter carefully and process carefully and debrief carefully, we can learn how to enter these states better in future sessions. I really think integration and very careful debrief, careful recording of your session after it's over, processing it, really sitting with the content of it is really important, because it establishes the baseline for your next entry into your non-ordinary state. And so it's like a cycle. And integrating your work as you go is really important to the next step in your work. Now, I want to mention that in my work, particularly since it was being driven by such highly amplified states of consciousness. In my work, I kept as many variables stable as possible. So for all these sessions, I worked in the same set and setting, same substance, same dose, same sitter, same recording process, even the same part of the country, because any of these variables can change some of the texture. And that's not bad to change the texture, but by standardizing the variables, I think it created a container which allowed my conversation with the universe and my communion with the universe to progressively get deeper and deeper over time. So by stabilizing the content, the contact, the mm-hmm. zone of contact that I made with the universe, it allowed the deepening to take place. Now, of course, what kind of communication or contact we have with the universe partly depends upon the headroom of the psychedelic that we're using. And all psychedelics, psilocybin, ibogaine, MDMA, 5-MeO-DMT, LSD, they all have certain qualities of how they engage consciousness, and they have a certain spectrum, a range of engaging. And I think one of the reasons I kept breaking through over 20 years, one level of consciousness after another, had to do with holding the posture, holding the setting, but also with the sheer power of the psychedelic that I was using. If I had been working with, say, psilocybin, I'm sure my experiences would have overlapped a great deal, but I don't think it would have had as much headroom, cosmological headroom, as working with LSD did.
And how did your wife then feel about the trip sitting duty? That's kudos to her on the dedication for that role as well. Was it hard to convince her to do that, or was she kind of with you in this purpose of the philosophical adventure?
Carol did this out of love for me. She was never particularly drawn to working with psychedelics. They were too much too fast, in mm-hmm. her opinion. She's a deeply spiritual person. And we eventually, after 24 years of marriage, we separated. And she has gone, we're friends and we stay in contact with each other and with our children, particularly around our children. She has gone on to complete her 3-year, 3-month retreat in the Vajrayana tradition. So she's a serious practitioner, and she has a deep spiritual orientation. It's lifelong, and it was a tremendous value to me to have her spiritual wisdom grounding me while I entered into this work. But it was never her work, and she did it because she knew I wanted to do it. And we always supported each other in our spiritual paths.
That's really neat. Now, thanks for sharing all this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, I'm really captivated by the very scientific approach that you took, or at least a very careful and deliberate and disciplined approach. And the way I imagine it is, by controlling for those variables, you were able to return to maybe the same drill site and just sort of auger down and get this very, very deep core sample of the cosmos, you know, very, very deep core sample of the universe. And, you know, as it manifested in you and you manifested in it, as opposed to what some psychonauts or people who are approaching psychedelics for therapeutic or spiritual exploration purposes do, where they just sort of pockmark the surface by not paying close attention to set and setting, or they're experimenting with many different types of substances.
I think that's true. There, of course, there's no right or wrong way to use psychedelics. There are so many ways of using them, and many good ways of using them. So I just happen to represent one particular strategy. I was trained as a philosopher of religion. I have a natural orientation towards precision and analysis. And so, particularly since I didn't fully know what I was getting into, I wanted to leave breadcrumbs in case I needed to work my way back out again. It turns out that was not a needed concern. I'm sorry, I'm losing my train of thought here a little bit.
Well, no, I guess I have a follow-up question here, Chris, because as a trained philosopher of religion, I think I've read, if not in the book, it might have been in the postscript that you wrote for Paradigm Explorer, that, you know, when you started approaching this work, you might have described yourself as an agnostic, sort of atheist-leaning agnostic. And I'm curious to hear how your belief in or relationship to the divine changed, if at all, as a result of your experience with this substance and this protocol.
Well, you know, basically through all the graduate studies and I went through, I basically studied my way out of religion entirely and out of theism and out of any belief in the divinity as I had learned it by studying world religions and the history of theology and philosophy. And so I began this work as not just an agnostic, but an atheistically inclined agnostic. It was like, okay, you're going to have to put up or shut up on this one because right now it doesn't look good. I mean, I think science has just gone through and wiped out anything that smacks of traditional religion, because the God of the religions of the Axial Age, that deity is just too small for the universe that science is showing us is here. Just the massive scale and scope and intelligence of it, and I think it just erased the blackboard, and we're still catching up with this erased blackboard. So I brought a mind that was not adverse to religion, but was adverse to theology in a way. And but when you begin to have experiences of the reality that the religions have been talking about, well, that changes everything very quickly. So that when one does this work and you go through cycles of death and rebirth and you go through this process of losing your reality or surrendering your reality as you have known it inside time and space, and you go through a death of that reality and a rebirth, you wake up in another level of reality, another dimension of existence. And you do that again and again in a systematic way, then the reality of a reality beyond space and time just becomes overwhelmingly clear and true to you. Mm-hmm. And your ability to understand it and to absorb it and to taste it becomes second nature. Now, in all the years I did this work and all the levels of consciousness I went through, I never encountered anything that might be recognized as a deity or even a personal spiritual guide, which is pretty common in many shamanic traditions. But I always felt myself to be engaging an intelligence that was essentially guiding my experiences or kind of feeding these experiences to me in an interactive, participatory manner. And this consciousness, boundaries of this consciousness kept deepening the deeper my practice went. In that context, I could speak about God, but I don't really like to because God has so many connotations in the West that I'm not comfortable with. And I could speak about divinity, but that's just kind of smuggling in, you know, through a side door. So I tend to speak about the creative intelligence of the universe because in one way, a way of understanding the scale and scope of what I actually experienced is to understand that the universe has a mind. And actually, the universe arises out of a mind. It arises out of a consciousness, and it's always sustained and nurtured by a more fundamental reality, which you can call it spiritual. You can call it dark energy, dark matter, you know. But now we know that 96% of the universe is invisible, dark energy, dark matter. So it's not that radical to sort of suggest that there is a reality behind physical reality. I think all our historical concepts of God have been profoundly incomplete, inadequate, and we are entering a period of history where we're basically going to be rewriting that story. And I think psychedelics have an important role to play because it lets ordinary mortals, in a way, just ordinary lay people, have firsthand contact with this vast expanse of spiritual reality that gives you experiences that you know are the kind of experiences that previously in earlier generations people would have described as the experience of God.
Mm-hmm. So, Chris, who are we in this story? You know, are we, as others have stated, are we sort of this you know, unique organization of molecules that is the universe experiencing itself, this each one of us a fractal, you know, that where the universe gets to joy in experiencing itself in a way that wouldn't have otherwise? Like, what do you think we are?
Mm-hmm. I think you say it pretty well. I think, you know, that question has so many levels to it, and it depends on how we want to frame it going in. We are clearly part of the creative experiment that the universe is. We are an aspect of it. We're not separated from it. We are our nature, our body, the cells of our biology arise out of this evolutionary masterpiece. And our mind, just as our body derives from the universe, our mind derives from the universe. Now, I know in our period of history, we're taught that the universe is a machine and it moves with the machine's blindness and it evolves through random mutation and genetic mutation and random variation and screening by necessity. But that's just a story that we've told, and it's not been a bad story, but it's a profoundly incomplete story, because when you sink down into the depths of your mind, you drop eventually out of your mind into deeper layers of mind, into the species mind, into the, you know, a solar system or galactic mind. And as you drop down into that, you engage, you find yourself confronting or being dissolved into an intelligence that is just stunningly vast. I mean, it's just a massive intelligence and a depth of love and compassion that's behind that intelligence. And it's this intelligence which is manifesting the universe that we experience. It's manifesting itself as the universe. And we are fortunate enough to be cells within this body of divine self-manifestation, fractally embedded in it, so that our story is part of its story. Its story is part of our story. Now, that's at one level, and then at a deeper level, if we add reincarnation into it, and of course, that's an assumed, in my worldview, not because of faith, but because of the empirical evidence that we have amassed at this point in time. My first book was on reincarnation, and I think that's just part of how nature functions. We don't really know how it came to function this way, but nature has found a way to fold learning forward, not only at the species level in a broad species evolutionary sense, but it's found a way to fold individual learning forward in a way that I think reincarnation is simply a higher octave of evolution. And once we add evolution and reincarnation into the story, once we understand that we are participants in this evolving universe for not just 100 years, but for 100,000 years, then the plot really thickens. Mm. Then we're looking at the universe is intensely involved in manifesting galaxies, solar systems, planets, life, self-aware life, and then evolving, reincarnating life that puts us on some type of profound co-footing with creation, with existence, so that we really are, our evolution and its evolution are really part of the same fabric. human evolution, individual evolution. They're really two different aspects of the same process.
So if you'll permit me, Chris, to just keep pulling on this thread, because it's one that's fascinated me and preoccupied me, frankly, for my entire life. I mean, this notion of who we are in relation to the universe, what is divinity? Because when we're preoccupied with what feels like the mundane, mundane of daily life, paying our taxes, going to work, that kind of thing. Yeah. And we think of ourselves as this, as I said before, sort of this fractal, piece of what you describe as this practically infinite intelligence, the substrate of which it sounds like is love. It causes me to think like, well, so have we always existed in some way, shape, or form as an individualized intelligence related to this grander one? Because when you talk about reincarnation, it makes me wonder, like, is there some continuity to Steve Thayer that goes back hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years that I just don't remember, right? Or is it each time we're deconstructed to our constituent parts and reassembled with new parts, and it's just sort of pieces that move forward in time? What do you think?
Yeah. Boy, you know, we don't know the answers to all the answers to those questions. We don't really know how reincarnation works. We don't know what the physics of reincarnation is. Even if we have evidence that reincarnation is a fact of nature, we don't know the nature of it, how it goes, how it works. But it seems to be that the universe is a learning system, and reincarnation is a part of a learning system. So because our consciousness did not begin with our body, but our consciousness goes back farther, we can use a concept like soul, some type of concept that holds and gathers the learning from all of the incarnations that we've experienced. How far back does it go? Two questions. How far back does it go? All right. And the answer is, nobody knows for sure, but all the cultures that have believed in reincarnation say it doesn't start with human beings. It starts before human beings. How far before human beings? Well, we're not really sure. Now, my sense is that it starts when individuality begins to emerge within the evolutionary matrix. And I'll use the term evolution frequently, as you know, as you've heard, but that, and I believe in the concept of progressive development, a progressive unfolding. But that doesn't mean I agree with the kind of standard textbook theory of what's driving reincarnation. So when I use the term evolution, I don't mean that theory, that reductive determinist theory. It's about learning. How far back does it go? Somewhere along the way, between grasses and chimpanzees, it's hard to think of individual blades of grass having individual consciousness. Mm-hmm. We usually think in terms of broad classes. But somewhere in the evolutionary process, an individuality emerges. And as that individuality emerges, there's a learning that deepens that individuality over time. And that's when I think reincarnation becomes possible. Classically, they look to animals that are, lower down the mammalian chain, but somewhere in the animal life form. But wherever it emerges, the next question is, what are we underneath these evolved changes? And I think the answer to that is that takes us down into a deeper level underneath the soul. And we ask, well, what is the essence of the soul? What is the essence of our individuality? What's the essence that makes this evolving individuality possible? And there, I think we find the same answers in psychedelic work that we find in the classic mystical traditions, classic high spiritual traditions, and that is the essence of the individual is the essence of the divine. The essence of the one is the essence of the totality. We are, in essence, derived from the divine, sparks of the divine. We've been sort of teased out of the unitive matrix of the divinity and been given the privilege of individuated existence, which then is polished and refined and deepened over thousands and thousands and thousands of years of going back and forth between spirit and matter, spirit and matter, spirit and matter, taking us onto a developmental process. But the essence of what we are is the divine itself. The manifestation of what we are depends upon how long we've been cooking. Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating. And how you mentioned karma earlier, how you viewed it going into this work and suggested that maybe it changed, but wondering how you view karma now in this broad perspective that you've been sharing.
It's simply as cause and effect. You know, it's karma vipaka, cause and effect. It's simply make in its course, the universe pulses with cause and effect, right? At all of its levels. But mm-hmm. here we're simply talking about a substrate of cause and effect. The causes that are set in motion by the exercise of our capacity to choose. We make choices, we inherit the consequences of those choices. In that new context, we make new choices, and then we inherit the consequences of those choices. So if we've been smoking two packs of cigarettes every day for 5 years, we're not free to not want that next cigarette, but we are free to begin to set in motion a series of choices that can free us from that addiction to those cigarettes. So we're constantly making choices. We inherit the consequences of those choices. One of the ways in which my thinking has changed over the years since writing Life Cycles, my first book, is that I have a much deeper appreciation of the synergistic relationship between individual development or individual karma and collective development or collective karma. I think that we have a tendency in the West to over-personalize the concept of karma, to really kind of tell the story of the individual soul maturing over many lifetimes and reaching enlightenment or whatever. And I think our species is evolving, pulsing every 100 years, right? In reincarnation. And there is a collective learning process taking place, which our individual learning process is part of. And so the boundary between collective learning and individual learning is porous. And I have much more respect or sensitivity to the collective karma that I might have previously seen as personal karma.
Yeah, wow. And earlier you mentioned the role psychedelics might be playing in this kind of evolution of consciousness these days. And when we were talking about that place between blades of grass and chimpanzees, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on Terence McKenna's like stoned ape hypothesis, and if that was an example of the universe between spirit and matter learning as it evolved, and if you viewed psychedelics as playing a role in history as well.
Terence's hypothesis there is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I don't have an opinion on that. I don't have any new insights to add to that. I hold it as an interesting hypothesis. I don't have any independent way of assessing that.
Yeah.
So I just don't know. Now, I do think that we are coming to a turning point in history. We are coming to a make or break point in history. And I think that psychedelics have a significant role to play. And they're giving us extra awareness at a time when we desperately need extra awareness. They also are giving us a form of accelerated and deepening healing at a time when we desperately need accelerated and deepening healing. Because I think that there is a tremendous inner fermentation process taking place, a tremendous detoxification taking place at the collective level as well as an individual level. And it manifests itself in our individual lives in terms of this kind of more uprushing of content, of karmic content, of conditioning, of pain and trauma that we've been carrying in our soul history. But I think this is happening not just to a few select individuals who are middle class, able to attend to this, but it's happening underneath us in our social movements and underneath the world at large. And I think psychedelics, by giving us an amplified experience of our consciousness and our consciousness and the consciousness that we are part of, it not only helps us heal and helps us manage this purification process, but it also gives us a wider worldview, which it only takes, you know, one good, deep psychedelic experience of communion with the deep structure of the universe to shatter materialism, the philosophy of that matter is the only thing that's real. I think Houston Smith was right that a mystical experience does not a mystic make, but a mystical experience can an atheist unmake, you know? And I think psychedelics have a very important role to play in that. Now, how far will this go? How deep will psychedelic healing reach in our culture? How fast would these insights realized under psychedelic communion change or contribute to the paradigm shift that's taking place, which is being driven by multiple disciplines right now? I don't know. But it seems that, you know, the fact that LSD was invented in the same decade that the nuclear bomb was invented, and the nuclear bomb has changed the order of global order, I think is maybe a significant synchronicity.
So speaking of this time in human development, and as somebody who has really dedicated his academic and personal life to exploring what it means to be human, I'm curious to know if you have an opinion on artificial intelligence. You know, some folks who talk about the way psychedelics are helping us learn who we are might be really, really important, given that we might be creating something that is different, but also conscious. I'm curious to know if you have an opinion. Yeah.
You know, I don't really have an opinion. It has not come up in any of my sessions. I finished my sessions in 1999. Artificial intelligence never came up in my sessions. I stand on the sidelines as a layperson and kind of an old layperson. I'm 74 years old, and this is really a younger generation's work. Mm. And I watch what's happening in artificial intelligence work just from the edges, and I can see that it's developing much faster than I could possibly keep track of personally. I'm concerned about it, but clearly it's here, it's happening now, it's going to have huge impact on us in the future. I don't know what role it will play, whether it will be a friend or an enemy over time. I'm more concerned about the ecological cliff that we're going over, because this is very, we can extrapolate, and we are getting a clearer and clearer vision of how the imbalances that we have generated in the industrial era are beginning to manifest with catastrophic consequences. Mm-hmm. And the cumulative effect of these ecological crises, which are going to keep hitting again and again until we get on top of this, and we're not anywhere near to beginning to get on top of it. This is turning the 21st century, I think, into a century of tremendous global instability and global unraveling and crisis. So that, to me, has been kind of focal point in my thinking. How artificial intelligence plays into this, I don't know.
And on the ecological front, how much of that realization of the problems that we face, how much of that came from these psychedelic deep dives, and or how much of it is just from kind of your experience in life? And did you get any insights, any ways you think psychedelics or the expansion of awareness or raising consciousness might help us in a better path forward?
Well, let's hold the second part of that question of how psychedelics might help us in a better path forward. And let me address the first part of it. Mm-hmm. Because this was one of the biggest surprises of my work. I mean, first, I had to let go of the framing of my work as personal journey, personal transformation, personal healing, personal awakening, spiritual awakening, get involved in a much larger dance with the species mind, with the collective unconscious, being catapulted from there into levels of archetypal reality, and then being catapulted into deeper causal levels of reality. And so I say this just to mark that I understand that what I'm about to say about human, where we are and where we're going historically, will sound outrageous and they will sound highly speculative. But my experience is very simply, when you work very, very deeply, far underneath the personal psyche, dropping into the collective psyche and into the creative intent underlying evolution, the evolution of our species, these things come naturally into focus in a way which make perfect sense from a quantum paradigm or a post-Newtonian atomistic materialist paradigm. So there's a chapter in LSD and the Mind of the Future and the Universe, which is the birth of the future human. And it's a chapter where I gather together all the experiences that took place in my journey that bear on this question: where is humanity now and where are we going? And it was one of the complete surprises to me that this came up in my sessions. And this is a long time ago, before I had any ecological awareness, you know, before I had absorbed the information that we're all absorbing today. These visions took place between 1991 and 1995. So, you know, a long time ago, I was completely naive about hitting our environmental limits, hitting our ecological limits, the crisis that was building in our culture. What began to happen is, tucked in around the edges, here and there, I began to be given visions of where humanity was in its evolutionary saga. I began to be given visions that we were coming to a turning point, a definitive turning point in human history, an evolutionary pivot. I began to be given visions that we are entering a magnificent period of human history where there was just tremendous blessings coming to us, a period of profound transformation, that the future of humanity would be radically unlike its present and its past. And there was some fundamental process that we were undergoing that was taking us there. But for the first 3 or 4 years of this, I was given these consistent visions of a future, but was given no indication of how we would actually get there. How was nature going to pull off? Because you look around us, it doesn't look very positive, guys. I mean, you know, more people are at the shopping mall than they are in transformative weekend workshops. Violence is escalating. How are we going to make this transition? And then in 1995, in December of 95, when I was very far along in my psychedelic work, I had entered a stage of work that I call the diamond luminosity material. So I was halfway through years of work in this very subtle, exquisitely sublime diamond luminosity work. And in the middle of that, in a rhythm when I was expecting to be taken back into the diamond luminosity, instead, I was dissolved into the species mind. So, and in that context, as the species, I went through a process, or I experienced a death and rebirth of the human family. I experienced a profound unraveling of life as we had known it, a profound challenging. it's hard to describe this because most of our experiences we experience from within a self-referential point. And it sounds ludicrous to say I describe the death of humanity as humanity. But I experienced this tremendous building crisis in the world and the unraveling of people's lives and the shattering of expectations and the shattering of systems until eventually humanity was reduced to the bare challenge of survival, just bare survival. It was so deep, it looked for a while like it was going to be an extinction event. It was a global systems crisis, which appeared to be driven by a cascading series of eco-crises. I wasn't given any details beyond that. I wasn't given any timetable. I wasn't given any sense of how this would happen. I was just taken into this deep cultural collective crisis. And then just when it was at its worst, we seemed to move through this crisis. And when we began to pick ourselves up on the other side of this crisis, we had been changed by this crisis. We had been changed radically. There had taken place an opening of the human heart, an opening of compassion, a profound change in human, we would say classically, in human nature. I would describe it as a shift in the fundamental structure of the collective unconscious. What we're looking at is what you might think of it as a shift in the plate tectonics of the collective psyche. When we moved through this crisis, as we began to reassemble ourselves, the entire world was saturated with new values, new perceptions of the good, new social institutions. This was a huge transformation of the human heart. And then I was given many instructions on the mechanisms, how we would make it through this crisis faster than we would think possible, given the pace at which history moves. And it has to do with understanding the function of the collective psyche as a field. This is going on maybe a little long, but the synopsis is that the collective psyche is a unified field. And this crisis will be so severe, it will shove not only individual psyches into a non-equilibrium, into a highly altered state, but it'll shove the collective psyche of humanity into a non-equilibrium or far from equilibrium condition. We have a certain knowledge about how physical systems, when they are shoved into a non-equilibrium state, behave. We've learned this from chaos theory, a number of different areas. There's a sense in which I was shown that the human psyche, when shoved into a similar non-equilibrium state, will exhibit some of the same characteristics, the capacity for rapid change, the emergence of new structures emerging from the floor of the collective psyche, that small iterations, small changes can produce dramatic outcomes. The bottom line of this is that we were going to be moving through this crisis much faster than we would think possible because of the severity and the negative impact this crisis was going to be having on lives all around the world. Subsequent sessions in the years following, I was given the experience moving into deep time again, moving beyond linear time, experiencing what I call the future human, experiencing the archetypal form of humanity. And I experienced this being is an extraordinarily beautiful being, just a magnificent being. This being is in some ways as far beyond us as we are beyond our earlier Homo erectus cousins. A being with a massive heart, a healed heart, an open mind, and not just a transformation of our heart and a transformation of our mind that opens up all sorts of possibilities, but actually a transformation of our sensory experience. We tend to have a mechanical understanding of a theory about how senses work. But I was shown, I was given the experience that the more consciousness is consolidated in our body, the more refined our sensory experiences can become. And so I had an experience at the very end of my journey of my vision 100 times sharper than it is in ordinary consciousness. And so the same applies to our hearing and all our other senses. So this is a pivot of a radically transformed human species, of a radically opened heart, radically opened mind, and a radically augmented physical capacity, right? So I think this is the story of our century. This is the story of the century that we're all dealing with, is how do we make this transition? How do we make this pivot from our present condition into our next evolutionary form? And this is what I call the birth of the diamond soul. But I'll stop here and give you a chance to ask any questions.
Well, one follow-up question on that last note, but I definitely want to get into the birth of the diamond soul. But do any of, as a professor of religious studies, and just wondering if any of the ways certain religions or philosophies view this line up with what you're describing. I'm thinking in particular of, say, the Kali Yuga from Hinduism, and, you know, thousands of years ago, the beginning of this dark age and materialism and corruption, and the ancient sages or rishis kind of retreat into the Himalayas or wherever, but haven't disappeared entirely. And then kind of that the turn of this age into the golden age or Satya Yuga, you have the return of wisdom, intelligence, compassion. And I'm wondering if any of those line up, or if you apply any frameworks to help understand this from your other studies.
In addition to the ones you mentioned, we have a number of Hopi prophecies, of course. There are a number of indigenous cultures that have been seeing this profound transformation. They've been talking about it for a long, long time. And it's interesting, and it does line up. I think the general perception is that we are in a period of darkness, but I would conceptualize that darkness as a period in which the conditioning of the past, which is, you know, a kind of the karmic patterns which shape the human psyche at deep structural levels, we're entering a period of infusion of grace, an infusion of energy, which is driving this past to the surface of our psyche so we can deal with it. All the hatreds of history, the divisions which we've carved in the human psyche, which we've carved on the planet, the divisions of race, the divisions of gender, the divisions of nationality, the divisions of haves and have-nots, this, all the patterns of splitting the world between in these categories are being driven to the surface, and there, all these toxicities are coming out of us and have to come out of us in order to make us available to the influx of the divine energy, which is entering. And you can think of it as entering us from above or coming up within us underneath. But I think there's something deeply true about these ancient prophecies, that we are, in a sense, in the age of the Kali Yuga. And we are coming into a profound new age. When it will hit us, how we will get there, I don't know. But I think there's a relation between these prophecies.
It is something that feels, as I hear you talk about it, Chris, it's something that does feel very true. And I, as a psychologist, you know, I've been very curious about the human psyche, and kind of like the questions I asked earlier about who we are have always been on my mind. Because when I look at the human organism, I see a being that is capable of so much more than we currently tend to produce, that is capable of great violence, that is capable of fear, and terrible behaviors that are based on fear, but also capable of great creativity and adaptation and love and inclusion and compassion. We're such a paradox. And and as terrifying as it sounds, the things that you described, this sort of maturity process, this next stage of development, it does sound necessary that we would need some kind of crisis to, I don't know if the right word is force or draw out this next stage of our development. And I look at my own psychedelic experiences and those of my clients and others that I've read about as almost an exercise in existential crisis, right? It's almost like going through a refiner's fire to kind of burn away the dross so that the purity of what you really are can come forward. But back to our conversation about integration, I think because of how intense that can be and how confusing it can be really hard to make use of in sort of our imminent life, right? Day-to-day life.
Yeah, it can. It really can. What happens, I think, is that once we get into this work deeply, we suddenly realize we're playing on a different playing field than we had thought we were playing on before. And it's a much bigger game that's afoot. And it's not about our own personal life and personal transformation, but we are involved in historic processes of enormous import. And so if you're going to engage the deep psyche, you're kind of going into the deep end of the pool. You're going into the deep water. And the deep water is moving very fast right now. And there's a tremendous kind of a bubbling taking place. And everybody has a certain tolerance for being able to handle the complexity and the intensity of what's taking place at that very deep level. So when we come back, we need to not only record as carefully as we can what is the nature of our visionary experience, but then we really have to take care of ourselves as we try to integrate those experiences. I'll tell you that it took me a year to recover from that experience, that session I told you about, the birth of the future human, that collapse, the death and rebirth of humanity. It took me about a year to really recover from that and to sort of stabilize that. And even then, I mean, for the years that I've held that vision, you really have to practice the arts of grounding. If you're going to go deep, you better be well grounded in all levels, physically, emotionally, psychologically, and socially, with your peer groups, because it's a demanding process that we're involved in. Now, my sense is, before, my understanding of how reincarnation works is we get to choose the life that we incarnate in. We are given a certain set of options of and we sort of see what we're going into if we choose the lives that we're going into. And that means, I think, that every person here on this planet has chosen to be here in the form that they are. And that means that all of us have chosen to incarnate at this very demanding time in history. We want to be a player in this demanding time in history. From a spiritual perspective, well, I'm back up. Be careful on this. I don't want to go too far too fast. But I think we all knew what we were getting into when we incarnated. And we chose to be part of this process for our benefit, for the benefit of our children and our grandchildren all around the world. And for the benefit of the divine itself, because the divine is working. I mean, this is not something humanity is doing. This is something nature is doing. And whatever the intelligence is that lies behind and within nature, that it's doing.
You know, this has always been a question I've had about this notion of choosing to incarnate. And if you'd rather not go down this path, we don't have to, Chris, but... You know, the idea that somebody would choose to incarnate as a baby born with fetal alcohol syndrome, or somebody would choose to incarnate as a kid who was born in the last year in some war-torn country or a place where there was a lot of disease and conflict. Again, if you'd rather not try to tackle that, it's okay. I know there are some things we just don't have answers to, but how does a reincarnation perspective grapple with those realities?
Yeah, in just terrible, terrible suffering, babies born without brain, without neocortex, and encephalic children, babies born into violent circumstances, destined to die, after a very short life with terrible pain, how can we possibly assert that there is intelligence, let alone compassion, behind in such a universe? And I think in order to see the wisdom and to see the intelligence, we have to look very deep. We have to look deep and we have to look wide, because on the surface, life is a mean son of a bitch, and life is cruel and vindictive, and it's this filled, it's decimated by circumstances that just crush the human heart. From a reincarnational perspective, the awareness is that our life did not begin with birth, and our life does not end at death. That our life is part of a larger story. Someone would choose a life that involves so much suffering is maybe an impossible question to answer from within, inside a time-space perspective, and from within an individual homocentric perspective. In order to perhaps glimpse some of the larger patterns of life, we really have to open up into a very large perspective, an evolutionary perspective, a spiritual perspective. I think the most important thing to be aware or to understand is that all of our suffering is conserved and used, and it's all of our suffering, all human suffering is experienced by the divine. There is no divine outside of human suffering, watching us suffering, doing something that's making it possible or not possible. But everything that humanity suffers, everything that the animal kingdom suffers, the spiritual world suffers at a very deep level. So,
yeah, I mean, if we are as we talked about before, the universe experiencing itself, it's not just the people with awesome lives that the universe is experiencing, right? It's every instantiation of the universe, every life, the ones that suffer and the ones that don't suffer as much.
And I address this in life cycles. Human suffering brings us to our knees, and I don't think we have an adequate understanding or explanation of it. In my experience, when I have been drawn into this larger overview, and when I have experienced the intelligence behind this process, I have found myself trusting beyond what I can understand. Mm. And I trust because of the quality of the being that I encounter that's behind these circumstances. So I can't understand all the pain behind all this. And I can come up with any number of kind of partial and incomplete theories for how this stuff works or how it goes. But in the end, I think we're ultimately brought to our knees in trying to understand it intellectually. But if you experience the love and wisdom of the universe, then it gives us confidence that there truly is a logic to it. And the universe is a hard taskmaster. Mm. And, when you look at pictures of Kali, the destroyer, and she's a liberator of brings about enlightenment, but she brings death and destruction in one hand and enlightenment at the other. These things go together. There is nothing easy or gentle about the love of the universe or the love of the divine. It is a fierce, fierce place that we are part of. It's a very, very demanding world. But the question is, does the universe, in a deeper sense, is it paying attention to our pain? Is there a way in which, by engaging our pain as conscientiously as we can, does it lead to our own development in the long term? And is the universe listening to us as we are in pain? And I think it is. I think it is an intentional process, even though I can't answer your question satisfactorily.
Well, it was a beautiful answer, and I really appreciate you taking it. And trying to answer that question, Chris, because I certainly feel like I'm on my knees And I think I read somewhere, maybe this was you or someone else, but that the divine, as you've described it, is something that we can experience, but not necessarily comprehend. And that concept has actually brought me quite a bit of peace as somebody who's, you know, a self-described truth seeker, really, really wanting to understand things, thinking that that would give me some kind of assurance that everything would be okay, or help me understand what I should do or shouldn't do, you know, kind of a typical experience of somebody who's looking for the answers. So permission to not know all the answers is quite comforting.
And Chris, do you have certain people you count as teachers, or like your philosophical and spiritual perspective and leanings now? I'm thinking of that question that, you know, I hope we can get into next, of how does one proceed on a path of exploration like this wisely? What are good preparatory you know, philosophies and spiritual frameworks and systems to check out or try on, perhaps?
Well, I had the benefit of being a professor of religious studies, and so I spent a lot of my life, my professional life, teaching courses in comparative mysticism, in Buddhism, in, you know, introductory courses in Eastern traditions and Western traditions. And so I got to study a lot of the masters and learn their stories. And they were always my kind of guidepost. The great masters, the great spiritual beings were always, even though my work was not focused on spiritual awakening, we haven't talked too much about that, but still the great masters were my touchstones. And I tried to hold myself accountable to them as I conducted myself in this unusual spiritual practice. Indigenous cultures, I have tremendous respect for. I have not academically studied them. I have a, you know, kind of a layman's reading of a number of books and a respect for them. And I really appreciate that people who are undertaking this type of work, it's very beneficial to do it under the tutelage of an experienced teacher, of a guide, of someone who can help them process what they're experiencing. That hasn't been my particular destiny, my particular work. I've never had a teacher. I've never been advised by an elder in a psychedelic community in this way. The only teacher that I've personally had has been the universe itself, and she has been a fierce and a loyal teacher. She's broken me down, ground me up, spit me out, and beat me severely. And she's also held me and blessed me and loved me and taught me more things than I ever imagined were possible. When we do this type of work, it's foolish to do it alone. These were my circumstances, and I had the constitution to survive it, and I had the companionship of my partner, who was a very wise spiritual woman who helped keep me grounded, and I had the advice of the elders that I was studying in my courses. For most people, when we do this work, it's good to do this work in groups. It's good to do this work under the guidance of someone who has more experience in these states than we do, because this is a new territory. And it's, when I say a guidance, I don't mean someone who's guiding our experiences, but someone who can help us enter these states safely, and someone who can help us understand and process our experiences when we come back out of that. And I think it's important to have people that we can talk to. This was one of the burdens of my particular journey, and that because I was working in isolation, because it was all illegal, I could not bring it to the office. I could not bring it to campus. I could not talk to my students about it. I'm a teacher. I love to learn and share, and I'm a gabber. So I could not talk about this stuff, and that's not a healthy way to be. It's good to have community that you can share your experiences with, and that you can listen to other people's experiences. And as that experience grows, we know that we're all in this together. We really learn from each other as we're going deeper into this. So I think it's really important to do this work in a responsible way with the guidance or tutelage of people who have more experience at it than you do.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. And I know time is whizzing by as it tends to do, but I'm just on the edge of my seat dying to know if there's anything you could share about the birth of the Diamond Soul, or however you put it, or that second part of the kind of evolution and ecology of consciousness, or where we might focus our intentions on a path forward.
Yeah. Well, about halfway through my journey, in the 38th session, in a year of great blessings, it's just enormous blessings, I was taken on an experience that was preceded with some very, very intense purification processes, very intense death rebirth process. And at one phase in this journey, I had the experience of all my former lives coming into me. I mean, I had done past life therapy before. I was familiar with about a dozen of my past lives. I'd already written the book on reincarnation, so I was comfortable with the idea of reincarnation. But I began to experience my former lives coming into me, and it was like winding a string around a kite spool. And what happened is they seemed to hit a critical mass. And when they hit a critical mass, they fused, and there was an explosion of energy, and all of these separate lives fused into one life. There was an explosion of diamond light out of my chest, and I was catapulted into a state of consciousness that was beyond anything that I had realized up to that point in time. I was an individual, but an individual beyond any frame of reference that I had known before. And I came, and then I was given a whole lot of teachings and over again so that I would understand what was happening. And this came to be, it changed my whole understanding of how reincarnation works and where it's taking us. The classic understanding of reincarnation in Eastern cultures is that, you know, you incarnate, you make some proof, you self-challenge, you make mistakes, you make progress, but basically you get better and better, stronger and stronger, more compassionate over time, until eventually you reach some type of spiritual realization, some awakening experience, enlightenment experience. And once you reach that, then you're free to leave the system of space-time. So it's an up-and-out cosmology. And all the religions of the Axial Age of the last 5,000 years are all up-and-out cosmologies. So you achieve salvation, and then, or you achieve enlightenment, and then the fruition comes in an off-planet spiritual paradise. My experience in my sessions, the teaching I received in my sessions, is that that is not an adequate description of what's happening. That's a first stage approximation that humanity made when they began to have sufficient depth of experiences, that they began to have contact with spiritual reality. They began to understand reincarnation. But it's stopping halfway. I think what I was shown in my experiences was that humanity is not simply evolving one lifetime after a lifetime after a lifetime, making small incremental improvements in our quality of the soul's existence. Sooner or later, all of our lives come together inside our physical existence. Now, we die, we expand into the soul, we incarnate into our narrow egoic experience, we die, incarnate into the soul, we incarnate in an individual lifetime. We know the soul in between our lifetimes, but if we keep this incarnational rhythm up long enough, and I have my students sometimes do this as an exercise, for 15 minutes we're doing this each lifetime, expanding out, sooner or later, the soul wakes up inside our physical existence. And this is what I call the birth of the Diamond Soul. When the soul wakes up inside our physical existence, not only is there a tremendous expansion of our heart and mind, but it changes our entire orientation. We focus on the long-term vision, the long-term good, the wide good, because we have, in a sense, an intuitive awareness of all the hundreds of people, thousands of people we've been in relationship with through history. We have been every race. We've been every religion through time. We've been up and down the economic ladder. We've had all the roles in history possible. So when all those lives come together and wake up into a singular consciousness, it radically changes one's perception of what's taking place, who we are, and where we're going. I think when people ask, what form will the future human take? And we're exploring this with all sorts of science fiction, you know, what the form of the future human will be. But I think it's really much more simple than that. We have been developing and gestating the future human for hundreds of thousands of years. Reincarnation, we've been gestating the future human through reincarnation for hundreds of thousands of years. Gestation is long. Labor is short and intense. I think we are entering a period of history of labor, and I think we are desperately trying to grow into the largest, deepest, richest version of ourselves, and that is the diamond soul. I think the diamond soul is being born in history. The diamond soul is the form that the future human would take, and imagine if the entire species went through this process. Not just a few Christ and the Buddha and Muhammad and a few saints privileged here and there, but if the entire species went through this transition, that they awakened spiritually to this deeper identity that's been gestating inside of them all these years. What an extraordinary species that would be. And what would that species, an extraordinary history that species would create. I think we've reached a point in history where we simply cannot run this planet out of egoic consciousness. We either grow up or we go extinct. And extinction is a tremendous evolutionary accelerator. So I think I think this crisis evolving this century is going to take us to our edge. But my experience is that we do make it through this crisis. I've experienced the future human as a task to be actualized and also an accomplishment that has already been realized. So from my personal perspective, I deeply believe that we will make it through this crisis. We will make it through the developmental challenges. And when we do, and we're looking back over human history and our individual soul history, we will recognize that everything, all the pain we suffered, all the hardship that we went through to get to this place, it's been worth it. It's been worth it. We're giving birth to a new child in history, and it will be worth it.
Chris, I am finding myself feeling very grateful to you for your life's work, for your willingness to share it. I'm glad that you decided to come forward and share with, you know, all of us, not just your students, that you had to, you know, do so almost covertly just by living the difference, but also now through your written work, through coming on podcasts like ours. It means a lot to me personally, and I'm just so grateful for your willingness to come on our show.
It's an honor to have this discussion with you, gentlemen, and it's an honor to share these ideas and this teaching with your audience. It truly is.
Thank you, Chris. This has been such a delightful honor and pleasure. So we'll cherish this conversation. Thank you for your generosity in sharing with us.
Thank you for your work, gentlemen. Thank you for the healing you bring into the world and the insight you're bringing into the world.
And Chris, is there anywhere in particular you'd like to point people, a website, any of your current work? Where can they find out more about you?
They can contact me through my website, chrisbaish.com. It's a website in need of an overhaul, but it's there. And I have posted, you know, things I've written there. And but, you know, I'm all over YouTube. Various podcasts and talks I've given are on YouTube. They can find, if they're if the articles, the things that I've written are not on my website, they'll be on academia.edu under my name there. All my articles are published there. So all the most important things that I've written are available. And they can reach me on my website. I'm not doing any structured teaching at present. I may be doing some retreats in the near future, but those are still in the planning stages. Right now, I'm just doing some talks here and there at conferences, maybe some retreats being coordinated by some of the people I've been working with individually. But basically, I'm just following the work out into the world. I really don't have an agenda right now. I'm responding to where the book takes me. People read the book, they get interested like you, and I'm just following it out.
Well, a Chris Bache retreat sounds awesome. I'll put it on my bucket list and I'll be looking for it. And we'll link to your website and places where people can find your work in our episode show notes. Again, thank you so much, Chris.
You bet. Thank you.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel, like the videos, and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.